2 Samuel chapter number 19 is where we will be this evening. 2 Samuel 19, as we continue on in our series, God's Grace in Weakness. And Pastor Derek did just such a great job last time of helping us see what was taking place in the passage right in the midst of the Civil War, unfortunately, there in the nation. And so we're going to pick up with that and finish out the chapter tonight, see the end of the coup, the end of the Civil War, and the beginning of the healing process that needed to take place in the nation of Israel. So 2 Samuel chapter number 19, I want to begin by reading verses 9 through 15 as we get caught up to speed here. Look at verse number 9 there, 2 Samuel 19. And all the people were at strife throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, "The king saved us out of the hand of our enemies, and he delivered us out of the hand of the Philistines. And now he's fled out of the land for Absalom. And Absalom, whom we anointed over us, is dead in battle. Now, therefore, why speak ye not a word of bringing the king," this is David, "bringing him back?" And King David sent to Zadok and Abiathar the priests, saying, "Speak unto the elders of Judah, saying, why are ye the last to bring the king back to his house, seeing the speech of all Israel is come to the king, even to his house? Ye are my brethren, ye are my bones and my flesh. Wherefore then are ye the last to bring back the king? And say ye to Amasa, art thou not of my bone and of my flesh? God do so to me, and more also, if thou be not captain of the host before me continually in the room of Joab." And he bowed the heart of all the men of Judah, even as the heart of one man, so that they sent this word unto the king, "Return thou and all thy servants." So the king returned and came to Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal to go to meet the king, to conduct the king over Jordan. Tonight, we're going to go all the way through verse 43 and see this idea that consequences may linger, but grace still abounds. And it's interesting how the narrator does this. In the previous events, where Pastor Derek did such a great job of covering at the end of 18 into 19, it's, you know, God is gracious, but the penalty of your sins or the consequence of your sin, they'll just keep on rolling in heavy fashion. And now it's like he flips the script to say, that's true, but also grace still abounds. So where are we at in our study? Just a quick reminder, a recap. The nation has gone through a civil war because of the split in the royal family. King David has done poorly, as we'll recap at the end, with his son Absalom. Absalom decides to start a coup and stir as many of the nation as possible to follow him. And so there's a split in the royal family and a civil war that results. It's so intense, David has to leave Jerusalem and he has to flee there. He's able to insert Hushai as a counsel in Absalom's coup to be his secret agent, his mole, his helper. And then there's Ahithophel, Bathsheba's grandfather, who hates David and is trying to get Absalom to act against David quickly. Hushai's counsel is followed, and that gives David time to organize his men, and he has Joab, his ruthless general, get ready for war with Amasa, David's nephew, the leader of Absalom's armed forces. Well, we saw last time the conflict, didn't we? These two forces meet in battle, and before they go to battle, David tells Joab one thing, right? Not be victorious. What does he tell him? Be gentle with my son. I mean, he's the dad. He's also the leader, and he says this to him: I don't want you to do anything to my boy. Has he led the coup? Yes. Are people dying because of him? Yes. But be gentle with my boy. Well, you guys remember what happened. The armed forces, they meet, and David's forces get the better of Absalom's. And as Absalom is retreating, he gets hung up in a tree, and Joab, in typical Joab fashion, goes to him, disregards the command of the king, and stabs Absalom to death, killing him expressly against the king's desire. So that's where we're at. Joab has killed Absalom. Then we open 19, David reacts, and he mourns and grieves for Absalom rather than celebrate the victory. He mourns so much that it brings bad morale to the officers, and what does Joab have to say? You're going to need to knock this off. This is unrighteous, and it's frankly unhelpful. You need to stop all this nonsense, if we could put it in that way. So now David has commended his troops, and he is now sitting at the gate there in Manahem. And as he's there, it's clear the end of the coup has happened. The practical retaking of the throne by David will take place. The civil war, for all intents and purposes, it's done. The coup is dead before it really ever got established. Now we need healing. Now we need to make amends in the nation of Israel. So the account opens with disunity in the nation, and spoiler alert, sadly, it will end with the same kind of disunity. But in between, we're helped by God. In between, there's hope. In between, there's grace. Why? Because we find David humbly and wisely dealing with various groups and individuals and modeling the Lord's heart and desire for them as people and for the nation. He shows grace to those who opposed him in different manners, and instead of seeking revenge, he looks for reconciliation. He shows prudence in dealing with a situation where it's hard to know what actually was true, and he could have been reactionary, but instead he was wise and reserved. He ultimately, again, seeks the well-being of the nation rather than use it as a time for vengeance or for personal exoneration. So amid persistent consequences from his sin, because that's what's taking place here, David, seemingly with God's help, seeks the unity of the nation. And tonight, as we explore this topic, consequences may linger, but grace abounds. Catch the thought we're going to learn in these verses between 9 and 43. Ongoing consequences from past decisions do not mean we're incapable of making godly decisions in the present. Now, I want you to catch that. You may be experiencing, a loved one may be experiencing consequences from past decisions, and the devil does nothing but want to reign that over us, doesn't he? But here in our passage, you'll see that may be true, and the consequences may be lingering, but that does not mean that there's not grace from God to have an ability today to live for God and make decisions empowered by his grace. So, as we think about consequences lingering and grace abounding, we want to consider the example of David and what he teaches us about letting God help us in and through such moments. First thought is this: David exercised humility and accountability by reaching out to former enemies. In fact, not only reaching out to former enemies, but trying to reconcile them as allies. So here we have verse 11 through 15. 9 and 10, the narrator gives us what's going on, right? We read it. The coup's over. The aftermath is strife. There's this disagreement. There's this arguing nationally about what do we do next? And what's their reason? What's their rationale? Well, they look at it and say this. Well, David was a great king. He defeated many of our enemies. He defeated the Philistines in fantastic, unbelievable fashion. But he also ran from his adult son. Is that the kind of king or leader we want? The adult son that we anointed king over us, he brought in a new era, and it fizzled very quickly. And now the debate is raging. What do we do with David? There is disagreement about what's the right course of action. Sounds a lot like an American political situation, right? Who's right? What do we do next? So that's where we find verse number 11. David sends emissaries to Zadok and Abiathar. Why does he do this? Instead of rolling in heavy and doing what he wants, he's trying to, with God's help, think of the greater picture of what their purpose is as a nation, as a supposed holy covenant people. And he says, how do I need to bring unity and healing through a devastating period? So he starts off with Zadok and Abiathar, the priests. He needs them as allies to help bring good nature and goodwill back with the men of Judah because of their respective positions as the priest. He needs them to go and engender good relationships, reminding them, listen, let's have solidarity as a nation, and let's remember, David's one of us. David's one, you know, let the past be buried. David's one of us. Let's remember what God has done. David is one of us. And so David enlists former enemies, trying to reconcile them as allies through the priesthood, but that's not where he stops exclusively. He then goes to the military leadership there in verse number 13. You remember we read it. What did it say? He moves to the military branch to enlist his own nephew, Amasa. He sends Abiathar and Zadok to get his nephew on board. And he offers him an olive branch. What's the olive branch? While you may have been the commander of the forces of Absalom, the coup starter who hated me, but you know what I'm willing to do? I'm willing to make you my general instead of Joab. Now, spoiler alert, you remember how Joab's character has been throughout all these narratives, right? This is not going to end well for Amasa, spoiler alert, right? But he does this, gives Amasa Joab's position to try to rally the men who were warring against him and who would follow Amasa in unity with David, and also punish Joab for his insubordination regarding killing Absalom. Now, verses 14 and 15, what do we read? These two moves galvanized the men of Judah. It says that David collectively bowed their hearts towards him as one person. They had unity together. And so much so, they all travel right to the edge of the Jordan to conduct him over as a royal emissary back to Jerusalem. You can see it on the map here. They're up a little bit northeast, and so they're northeast there. Jerusalem is down south past that furthest line. And so they've been up there. That's where the battle took place. And now they're going to start traveling south. They're going to go across the Jordan from east to west and head towards Jerusalem. And you've got to catch the scene here as we continue reading. You'll see it. This is not David and a few fellas. This is going to be thousands of people going back showing unity that David is our king. Though they were at war not a few days earlier, now it's going to be solidarity. Now there's going to be the healing of the nation for the promotion of God's purposes. It's important to note that David could, catch this, could have behaved as the normal kings of their time. If you've read any history at all, when the king who's trying to get into power or the king who's been deposed gets back into power, what do they normally do? Kill them all. They clean house. It doesn't matter your relation. It doesn't matter your value. It was typical for kings in that time to do what? Make sure there were no possible foes left standing, no possible persuasive people left in a position that could harm them or threaten instability. So David, by cultural standards, could have done what? Just rolled in heavy and just wiped out as many people as possible. Because after all, his forces just defeated Amasa and Absalom's forces. He has the numbers. He has the acumen through Joab. Joab is this. He is a ruthless commander. He could have done what would have been completely normal for cultural standards. Though these men were at fault, though these men probably deserved punishment in some way or another, David elects to value them as covenant nation people. And here's a beautiful thing. He gives them a path back. He could have asked for all their lives as a sacrifice for what he's gone through. But what did he do? In humility before God and evaluating God's desire for the nation of Israel, he takes enemies and seeks to reconcile them. He gives them a path back. Now, friends, it's not lost on me. This is an example of political shrewdness for sure. But greater than political shrewdness, this is an example of grace and undeserved trust. He elevates the needs of the nation and thereby their holy purpose. Instead of his agenda, he's coming back all the way back to Exodus. And what's he saying? The purpose that God created us for as a nation, the purpose we're supposed to have as a light to the unsaved people around us, we need to get back to that. I've been foolhardy for too long. My bad choices have screwed up my son. My son has screwed up this nation. Let's get back to what we're supposed to be, the holy covenant people of God, declaring, showing the God of the universe is with us and others need to turn to him. Our friends, we see this great example of David taking enemies and trying, you can't make people, but trying to reconcile and give them a path back. So many times in our lives, we come across people who, by our own choices or usually by maybe their choices, become at odds with us and have an adversarial relationship. It hurts. It stings. If you've been at fault, ask forgiveness. Seek it through repentance. But when it's towards you and you can't control it and it's no fault of your own, all you can do is appeal to God, but keep the bridge down on your side as best you can. Secondly, tonight, as we consider the consequences, but seeing grace abound, David exercised grace by pardoning a former critic. Let's read verse 16 through 23 together and see who comes next on the scene. David goes to Abiathar. David goes to Zadok. He sends them to Amasa. But now pick up here at verse number 16. And Shimei, the son of Gera, a Benjamite, which was of Bahurim, hasted and came down with the men of Judah to meet David. If you remember chapter 16, you better believe he hasted, right? And there were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him. And Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons and 20 servants with him. And they went over Jordan before the king. So this is a swell of people coming to David. And there went over a ferry boat to carry over the king's household and to do what he thought good. And Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king. And Aziz would come over to Jordan. And he said unto the king, let not my lord impute iniquity unto me. Neither do thou remember that which thy servant did perversely the day that my lord the king went out of Jerusalem, that the king should take it to his heart. For thy servant doth know that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I'm come to the first of this day of all the house of Joseph to go down to meet my lord, the king. The theme from the previous verses remains the same, but those involved look different. David's gone to some, now people are coming to David. Former enemies, now trying to be reconciled and are reconciled. Now it's former critics trying to be reconciled. Verse 16 and 17, what do we see? Shimei and Ziba receive word of the acceptance of David's return to the kingship from their own countrymen. So what do? They give the sizable group not to go attack, but try to show solidarity as well. Hope they'll be in David's good graces. They don't know yet, do they? And so as they approach David and the royal family's coming across, who's right in the front trying to get through everybody? Shimei. The way I picture this scene, and you know, forgive it, this is my imagination. If you've ever been on an international flight and they call to line up, what happens? I mean, just there is no order at all. Or as soon as the seatbelt buckle goes off on a plane, what do people do? There's always that one person trying to push past everybody. Excuse me, I've got a connecting flight. Excuse me. And they push back past everybody as fast as possible. I kind of see Shimei. There's 1,000+ people there. He's like, excuse me. He's out into the water. He's sopping wet. And what does he do? He throws himself down in front of David. Why would Shimei need to do this? Well, let's go back and remember chapter 16. As David is being deposed by his son through the coup and he's having to leave Jerusalem, who's there to give him a helpful goodbye? Shimei, throwing rocks at the Lord's anointed, yelling cursings at the Lord's anointed, even calling into question if he's worthy to be called an Israelite, if he should even be in the covenant nation in any way, shape, or form. So the last time these two saw each other, it wasn't very good, was it? David was at a disadvantage. Shimei's walking tall, you know? Who's walking tall now? David is. Who's running through the water trying to just get in front of David as fast as possible? Don't let anybody else tell you I'm here. I'm coming myself. He goes before David, and what does he do? He lays flat on the ground. No thought of what's on the ground. This is a man who was in power, now sees he's powerless. He goes right in front of David, and in humility bows himself. And hear the message. What did he say? I have kind of screwed up, but you know, David, it really wasn't my fault. What did he say? I've sinned. He took accountability for it before God and David. I have sinned. Hear the request. He knows it's an impossibility, but he's just trying to show his sincerity. Would you please forget everything I did and spare me? Can David forget? Not until senility takes it from him, right? How many critics have you forgotten? How many coworkers have you forgotten that have stepped on you or stabbed you? How many family members have you forgotten who've unjustly said things about you, right? Shimei knows I cannot make you do this. What's he asking for? He's asking for mercy. It's his only hope. The only thing he can hope for is that David will follow the example of their God. Why? Shimei has nothing to offer. He can't expunge his guilt. And so what does he have to do? Just plead for mercy as a former critic. All he can do is plead for mercy as a former critic. What's his motive? Well, we don't know to a certainty. It could just be shrewdness and tactical on his end. But by the passage, it seems he is contrite genuinely before David. I need mercy. So it's kind of a beautiful scene, isn't it? Somebody, the last time he encountered David, throwing rocks, being nasty, now forgive me. Can I get a do-over? But then there's Abishai. Look at verse 21 through 23 and see his response. This is Joab's brother. Look at verse 21. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, answered and said, should not Shimei be put to death for this? Because he cursed the Lord's anointed. And David said, what have I to do with you, ye sons of Zeruiah, that ye should this day be adversaries unto me? Shall there any man be put to death this day in Israel? For do not I know that I am the king this day, king over Israel? Therefore the king said to Shimei, thou shall not die. Well, could you put yourself there? Can you imagine how Shimei had to have felt in that moment? It's tense. You have Abishai doing what? Coming up and calling for his life. Abishai was the first man who vocalized his readiness to kill him back in chapter 16. Remember, he's throwing rocks, he's cursing. And what does Abishai say? Is there any reason you don't want me to pull out my sword and go take that guy's head off right now? I can do it. It's no big thing to me. I'll go do it right now. And David says, no, I deserve it. I deserve whatever criticism there is due to my choices. And now Abishai's in the same spot again. And what does he say? He doesn't ask a question. He really gives David an imperative, doesn't he? Are we going to let this happen again? Are we going to make the same mistake twice? I want to see him executed for, quote, breaking the law of God. It just so happens Abishai's glad to be the hand of the Lord's justice in his mind. Now, did Shimei violate the Torah? Well, he did. Exodus chapter 22 and verse number 28, Shimei did speak ill against the leader, and he is worthy of some kind of punishment, but the law did not dictate what he would be deserving of as a punishment. But Abishai consistently sought the death penalty with folks he sought that he thought deemed it right. He and Joab, there's just this theme of ruthlessness with them. 1 Samuel 26, David and a few men are in Saul's camp by night, and what is Abishai more than ready to do to Saul? Hey, David, do you want me to go kill that guy? You pop over to 2 Samuel 3, Joab and Abishai have a chance with Abner to kill him and revenge their brother. Guess what they do? They do it. Chapter 16, Shimei's throwing rocks. What's Abishai ready to do? Do you want me to kill him? Now in this portion, do you want me to kill him? Do you get the theme here? Abishai is more than glad in his mind to take matters into his own hands when mercy needs to end and judgment by his decree needs to begin. David, without absolving Shimei of guilt for breaking the law, defers to a higher value in the law. What's he say? Are we really going to kill some people? Am I the king right now? Well, yeah, David, you're reestablished as the king. It sure seems that way. Everybody's on board. It sure seems like that's happening. Then why would we kill somebody right now? Why would we kill another covenant nation member for things they've done in the past that they're confessing and repentant about? Why, Abishai, do I need you to go and do this to this man? David's saying, my throne's established. What merit will it do us to kill another Israeli? And so he makes an oath not to kill Shimei. And you'll see that out throughout the rest of Samuel and Kings that David keeps his word. See, David here is a reminder of God's delighting in mercy, particularly upon the repentant. Does our God delight in mercy? He sure does. But does he love to display it towards those who are repentant? Absolutely, he does. I mean, after all, if anyone should know what it is to receive mercy when they're guilty, who should that be in this passage? King David, right? How easy it is, my friends, to have an Abishai attitude towards others when we know we have a David and Shimei past. I want you to think of it. That's going to be on the screen. How easy it is for us to have this ruthless, cutthroat attitude towards others when we know what we are, and we know what we've chosen, and we know how we failed. But what does God call us to do? He calls us to forgiveness and mercy. Now, it's important we qualify this, okay? God is not telling us to ignore transgressions. That's not just, it's not holy, it's frankly not possible. God's not calling us to condone sin. God's not calling us to excuse a need for reconciliation, okay? But valuing the other image bearer as someone that God loves and someone God can use, even if their previous choices have been substantially harmful to us, is what God calls us to in his kindness and in his nature. Friends, hear it, particularly our young folks who are in school and going to be headed into adulthood even more so in the future. You're always going to have a critic in your life. I worry for a culture who thinks criticism should not exist in life. It doesn't matter if you've done the best thing in the world. There's always going to be a negative Nancy out there. There's always going to be somebody to criticize it, right? So critics are present in our life. They seek to blame us for a lack of grace in their own life. They seek to blame us for their guilty conscience they're bearing in their own mind. They want to blame us for enjoying being a disciple of Christ and trying to call them to the same. They want to blame us for trying to help them come to Christ away from paganism or to grow in Christ away from carnality and fleshliness. There's going to be critics. What do? Oh, we seek their spiritual well-being, even if it requires difficult chats, and we don't harbor animosity towards them. That may be tough, but it is possible with the grace of God. It's possible to be a realist and not be a cynic. A realist and not be bitter. Be clear in grace without harboring hatefulness. You know the details, but you're not angry about it, right? Did it hurt? Sure it did. But you don't have to keep acting out on that hurt. But it doesn't mean like, oh, everything's fine. Because until there's reconciliation, things aren't fine. That's not just. So seek their spiritual well-being. Be real. Push for that reconciliation. Push for grace. But you can't change a critic, and God knows them, God knows you, and God will take care of everything else. You don't have to worry about what everybody thinks about you or what's said about you or to you. And further, some Shimeis may eventually repent and become co-laborers rather than critics. You see some of this in the New Testament, don't you? Do you guys remember Jesus' half-siblings? How many of them were critics while he was in the middle of his ministry and presentation as the Messiah? All of them. How many have converted after the resurrection? Many of them. You see, my friends, God can do a work through the work of critics in our life, and he can do an eternal work in their life, and we can be a part of that. And David shows us a great illustration of this with Shimei. Thirdly, though, David exercised prudence by weighing out the contrary narratives of Ziba and Mephibosheth. Look at verse 24. There's yet another person who runs to meet him, and maybe that's a poor choice of words, who is transported to meet him in verse number 24. Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king and had neither dressed his feet nor trimmed his beard nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came again in peace. And it came to pass, when he was come to Jerusalem to meet the king, that the king said unto him, and he has the right to ask this question based on what happened earlier, wherefore wentest thou not with me, Mephibosheth? Mephibosheth answered, my lord, O king, my servant, this is Ziba deceived me. For he said, I will saddle me an ass that I may ride thereon and go to the king because thy servant is lame. And he has slandered thy servant unto my lord the king. But my lord the king is as an angel of God. This isn't flattery. This is genuine, as you'll see. Do therefore what is good in thine eyes. For all my father's house were dead men before my lord the king. Yet didst thou not set thy servant among them that did eat at thine own table. What right therefore yet have I to cry any more unto the king? The king said unto him, why speakest thou any more of this matter? I've said, thou and Ziba, divide the land. Mephibosheth said unto the king, yea, let him take all, For as much as my lord the king is come again in peace unto his own house. So you have a former critic finding forgiveness and reconciliation and usage for the covenant nation. And now you have Mephibosheth, somebody that has been told to David that he was a traitor. I don't know how long it was after Shimei that Mephibosheth comes to David, but he makes the journey as best he can as a handicapped man dependent upon others. And he has to face David. Why? Because it's obvious to Mephibosheth that Ziba has falsely said slanderous things about him to David. He knows he needs to get to David and try to bring some level of clarity. And so he goes to David and he wants to have a conversation. He comes to the king in a manner that frankly was inappropriate for their time. We saw it there in the verse. What does he do? He approaches them in a way that's not appropriate for culture. In their time, if you approach somebody who is royalty, you had to come with decorum. You had to come with respect. You had to have that evidence in what you wore, how you came, when you came, what you said. All those things mattered. Those things are very different than obviously our great creator and our great savior who lets us approach him as unworthy people. He welcomes us into his church and he celebrates us like he talks about in James 2. There is no class. There is no trying to impress. There is no flaunting of wealth. There is the opportunity to gather together. But that's not how secular kings did it in their time and maybe even today. So here he arrives dirty, unshaven, and in stinky clothes. It's how he has lived since David was thrown out. He has shown himself in mourning. He's shown himself as ceremonially unclean until David would be restored by God as the anointed king over all of Israel. And such an action showed his loyalty to David, even though Ziba had slandered him and made false accusations about him. And so what did we read? David says, I mean, I see how you're dressed. Then why didn't you come? Where was your solidarity with me when the coup began under Absalom? If we took time and backed up to chapter 16, 1 through 4, we would be reminded that Ziba approaches David as he flees the city. And when David asks about Mephibosheth, he says what? Oh, your servant Mephibosheth that you were gracious and brought to the table with you? He stayed behind. He stayed behind hoping that your son will reinstall him and the house of Saul will have power and rise again. Now here Mephibosheth is contradicting that narrative. His side of the story is what? That didn't happen. Ziba lied about that. Ziba lied to me about how he was going to connect me with you and get me out of the coup zone. That's what really took place. All he can do is what? Just like Shimei, plead for mercy. Catch his language. He calls David my Lord, and this is a term of respect, not so much divinity, right? My Lord. He calls him an angel of God. He talks about what's right in your eyes, do it. He says, I'm your servant. Notice the grounds he gives for his defense. David's kindness in the past, he's not forgotten. He's not resentful at it at all. Mephibosheth remembers sitting at the table. Remember his outlook that he expresses. He says what? I have no right or need to ask or expect anything from you. Do what's right in your estimation. So David seems to shrewdly devise his plan to figure out who's telling the truth. Is it Ziba? Because remember, Ziba's in the crowd. Or is it Mephibosheth? Who's the liar? And kind of a foreshadowing of what Solomon, his son, would do in the future to figure out a dispute, here's what David says. All right then, I gave you all of Saul's land, but Ziba told me you betrayed me. So I gave it to him because he did aid me in information on the way out when the coup was taking place. So here's what we're going to do. You're going to get half, though you're the rightful heir, and Ziba's going to get half. I feel this is a test to show who's genuine. Whoever whines is what? Likely the liar. But check Mephibosheth's response. Mephibosheth's response wasn't to try to vindicate his side of the narrative. It shows his trust in David and his heart for God. What did he say? You know what? You can give it all away. You can give it all to Ziba. As long as you are reestablished, and implicitly what that means, I'll be back with you at the king's table. I'll get to be in your presence again, in your company again. As long as I'm back with you, I don't care. Give the whole thing to Ziba for all I care. His heart is that he trusts David's heart following God's desire in this matter. David, elects to exercise mercy and believe God's best for folks, even if the narrative seemed confusing. What did David do with Shimei? Left the door open. What did he do with Mephibosheth? Leaves the door open. See, Paul calls us to this kind of thinking in 1 Corinthians 13, does he not? Love does what? Love thinks no evil, believes all things, hopes all things. It doesn't mean we're suckers. It doesn't mean we're gullible. But it means that even when there's criticism, even when there's confusion, we will still filter our thoughts and therefore form our words from a biblically based perspective that recognizes the wickedness of sin in our own lives and the lives of others, but knows what God is able to do even in the midst of such moments. David is being an example of God's character with Zadok and Abiathar and Amasa and Shimei, and now even between Ziba and Mephibosheth. So lastly, as we pull this down to a close, David then exercises generosity in a deferential way to Barzillai. Finally, another ally approaches David. This guy cracks me up in a funny way. Barzillai travels 55 miles. You can see the map here. You see where the lines are at and whatnot. That area above that, Gilead and then Rogelim, he's up past that. So this octogenarian makes a 55-mile road trip. Now, that doesn't strike us as very exciting, does it? Or like, wow. He's 80-plus years old, making a 55-mile journey by foot, by cart, or by animal. Have you ever ridden a horse for more than a few minutes? Some of you right now who maybe are a little more around his age, how does that sound, right? But this man has been a staunch ally and friend of David. He's this wealthy octogenarian, a Gileadite, who remained loyal to David, and when he was on the run from Absalom, gave him food and care in the attempted throw over by Absalom. So he cared for David. And now David, remembering his generosity and his loyalty, seeks to show appreciation by giving a prestigious appointment to him. So Barzillai makes this journey down to see David there, not because he has to, but because he wants to. He's glad for what God's doing in the nation and in the life of David. And so he makes this 55-mile trek to David, and David says, I'm so glad you're here, basically. You know what I want to do? I want you to be with me in the kingdom. Look what he says here in verse number 31 of chapter 19. Verse 31. Now Barzillai, the Gileadite, came down from Rogelim and went over Jordan with the king to conduct him over Jordan. Now Barzillai was a very aged man, even 80 years old. And he had provided the king sustenance while he lay at Mahanaim, for he was a very great man. And the king said to Barzillai, come thou with me, over with me, and I will feed thee with me in Jerusalem. And I love his response. He says to the king, how long have I to live? I don't know if he's a pessimist. He just maybe seems like a realist here. How long do I have to live that I should go with the king unto Jerusalem? I'm this day 80 years old, and can I discern between good and evil? Can thy servant taste what I eat or what I drink? Can I hear any more the voice of singing men or in singing women? Wherefore then should thy servant be yet a burden unto my lord the king? Thy servant will go a little way over Jordan with the king, and why should the king recompense at me with such a reward? Let thy servant, I pray thee, turn back again, that I might die in my own city, be buried in the grave of my father and my mother. And behold, thy servant, Kimham, let him go over with my lord the king, and do to him what shall seem good unto thee. The king answered, Kimham shall come over with me, and I will do to him that which shall seem good unto thee. And whatsoever thou shalt require me, that will I do for thee. And all the people went over Jordan, and the king was come over. The king kissed Barzillai and blessed him, and he returned to his own place. Then the king went on to Gilgal, and Kimham went on with him, and all the people of Judah conducted the king and also half the people of Israel. So in this final person who comes onto the scene here with David, it's his ally, and David wants to reward him. But he wants to do it in a way that is a blessing to Barzillai, and Barzillai does what? He says, hey, I sure appreciate it, but I don't know how many years I got left. And frankly, if I came down with you, what good would it do? I wouldn't be able to enjoy the position. I don't really add any value. I'd just be a drain on the taxpayer. I'd be a burden to you. Here's what I'd like you to do. Will you take my son, Kimham, Every time I say this, I keep wanting to say Ken Ham. I don't think Ken Ham went with him, but Kim Ham. Kim Ham. Now, we don't know necessarily who he is. The text doesn't say directly who he is. But implicitly, from a later passage that describes him as Barzillai's son, and according to Josephus, a Jewish historian, this is his son. So basically, he says to David, I don't want to go. I want to die where I want to die, around the people I want to be around, but take my son. Install him in your kingdom and do whatever you would do for me. Whatever you think is wise. I trust your kindness. I trust your character that you'll do justly. You'll do right before God for my son. David's response is what? Well, okay. But here's what I want to know. How do you want me to treat him? I was going to do whatever you wanted to do to you. So what do you want me to do for your son? There's no demands. There's no offense that Barzillai didn't accept his generosity. He just wants to be a blessing in a way that's actually a blessing to his friend, who is a blessing to him at one of the most perilous times of his life. So David, again, is seeking to be a blessing to those who are a help to him, and he isn't prideful about it. He just wants to do whatever he can to aid his friend, and that's how he's going to do it, to the next generation. This is kind of a trait of David, isn't it? Generosity. Generosity to those who can't earn it and those who don't deserve it. Could Mephibosheth do anything to earn it? No. Does Kim Ham have any kind of claim here? No, his dad had a claim. But David has a heart of generosity just like his God. Now, I wish that's where the story ended. Right, we read it there in verse 41. It's wrapping up. They go to Jordan. They're going to cross over. Goodbye, my friend. I'm not going to see you before you die. He gives them that ceremonial kiss, says, goodbye, love you, man. And on we go as this big troop of galvanized Israelis going towards Jerusalem to be reestablished. The kingdom is healed. But look at verses 41 through 43. And behold, all the men of Israel came to the king and said to David, why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen thee away and have brought the king and his household and all David's men with him over Jordan? All the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, because the king is near kin to us. Wherefore then be ye so angry for this matter? Have we eaten all of the king's court? Or hath he given us any gifts? Basically, are we just mooching? And the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, we have 10 parts in the king, and we also have more right to David than ye. Why then did ye despise us, that our advice should be not first had in bringing back our king? The words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel. Catch what's taking place here. David has gotten, quote, back on track with the help of God. He has been gracious, making godly decisions in the midst of difficult times for God's glory. But David continues to face the ongoing consequences for his sin. The chapter ends with contempt between the tribe of Judah and the nation of Israel at large. What's going on here? This is like a weird passage, isn't it? There's this group of people yelling at that group of people, and they seem to be going back and forth, and louder and more angry it becomes. One group is saying, we should have had the prestige to bring the king back. And the men of Judah are saying, ho, 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 he's our flesh. He's our kindred. We have the honor to do this. And so there's this bickering pride fest taking place here. Pride fest back then, not in our today's culture. So there's this bickering taking place and going on. And there's heavy accusations. Israel says basically to the men of Judah, you've kidnapped the king, which is a capital offense, and you've cursed us, your fellow brethren. You all deserve to die. I mean, that's how absurd this is getting, these grown men yelling at each other. In this shout down situation, one could step back and say, well, who's right? I would say it doesn't matter. This is the ongoing consequences of what? David's sin. Though unified for the present, the divide is still looming in the nation. So what do we have to do? We have to trace it back. How do we even get to this point? Just trace it back. David not holding others accountable for their sinful choices. Right? Yeah, but let's think about it. Due to the coup, this is taking place. Due to the bitter son not engaged by his father or held accountable, this is taking place. Due to David not holding others accountable for their sinful choices like Amnon, this is taking place. David not holding himself accountable with the sexual assault of Bathsheba and murder of her husband. That's why this is taking place. We could put it this way. The sword has gone, as it was prophetically stated by Nathan the prophet, from his house, and now it has spilled out into the nation of Israel at large. Did Shimei make his own choices? Sure he did, but trace it back. Did Ziba make his own choices? Sure he did, but trace it back. Did Amasa make his own choices? Yes. Trace it back. Did Zadok and Abiathar choose to go with Absalom? Yes, but trace it back. One may wonder how many of these transgressions would ever have been chosen by the people we just listed if David had just been accountable. Catch it, it was bit by bit though. Bit by bit, ever increasing in its destructive force, but it didn't have to be so. The consequences are raging as just ripples from the rock David dropped in the nation years before. Friends, you've heard me say it repeatedly, and it bears repeating as well. The gradual trajectory change in your life, spiritually speaking, is one of the devil's largest looming tools. What do you mean, Pastor? The devil is not necessarily as interested in strategy of the big, awful, no comeback from moment. He knows he doesn't have that much opportunity with you all for the big, no comeback moment. So what does he have to do? He has to set those kind of ugly moments up through what? The slow spiritual trajectory slide. And it is bit by bit by bit. What does that look like, Pastor? Well, it looks like this. The person who once loved Christ and was fervent about telling people about Christ can now not tell you the last time they've tried to engage a soul about eternity. Spiritual trajectory slide, bit by bit. The person who used to talk highly of their spouse and what God was doing in their marriage now is looking for an open ear to criticize about their spouse and find sympathy. The couple who used to talk to their neighbors about Christ or getting Christians into church now only talk to their neighbors to gripe about the HOA. Family who used to honor the gospel in missions and the gospel mission of the church, and they were engaged and they were involved. Now it's time for sports on Sunday. Now it's time for band on Sunday. Now it's time for another weekend trip. Now it's time for work on Saturdays and Sundays and Mondays. And it just goes on and on chasing this realm. If you've been in church any length of time, you've seen this. The people who used to pray for their pastors now blame them for their failures as Christians or parents. The people who used to love their church now can't stand it. I'm going to make sure everybody knows about it. That didn't happen overnight. What happened? It was bit by bit by bit. See, David didn't get to the issue with Bathsheba and Uriah just in that moment. It was a trajectory slide. The nation didn't end up in civil war because it was just this one moment. It was a trajectory slide. But take hope. Even in the midst of such tragic bookends, the opening and the ending of this chapter, David still made decisions that honored the Lord. He still made decisions that showed the character of God in the midst of such ugly moments. And due to his humility, it's implicit then through this chapter that God aided him. Even with consequences lingering, it didn't paralyze him from being obedient in the present. But brothers and sisters, I want to encourage you. You and I sometimes find ourselves in a making of our own or somebody else, and we feel all frustrated, and it's from the past, or it's even fresh and in the present. But that doesn't mean today can't be different with the help of Almighty God. What do we have to do? Avail ourselves to him. So what decision do you have from the past, whether known to you or others, or it's just tucked in the depth of your own mind, where the consequences you know are still evident and it's painful to remember or see? What moments does the devil remind you of often to try to make it a barrier to you serving Christ? What items trigger his whispers that you're not worthy to be used today because of, and then he fills in the blank to you? What moments make you doubt if God would ever be willing to use someone like you ever again for his work or his purposes? I want us to recognize in this chapter the consequences, they're lingering. There's no doubt about it. But even in the midst of those consequences and these ugly bookends, in the middle you find David with the grace of God, and there is hope, and there is help, and they were able to get back on track for what God wanted to do in and through their lives individually and then nationally for his glory. Consider for a second, if this is not true, then none of us really have much hope for the future. If it were not true that consequences may linger but grace still abounds, then none of us should still be married. If it's not true that consequences sometimes linger but grace still abounds, then we wouldn't have the opportunity to influence offspring for Christ. We wouldn't have the opportunity to be in his church. I wouldn't have the opportunity to be a pastor. You wouldn't have the opportunity to serve. We wouldn't enjoy being a part of his ministry. We wouldn't enjoy decade-long friendships with various people in the family of God. Have we blown it at times? Of course we have. You have, I have. There's nobody under any auspices here about that. Does it mean that there's not going to be consequences? Of course not. Does it mean we won't struggle about it? Of course not. But what do we have to do? We have to keep going back to what's true about God and us each day, every day, that he's gracious and it abounds even in the midst of consequences. He's gracious and it abounds even in the midst of consequences. So my brothers and sisters, ongoing consequences from the past decisions, they're there. They may sting even still today, but it doesn't mean we're incapable of making godly decisions in the present. As we have a moment of invitation, I just want to invite you to consider if you are struggling with something that the devil keeps throwing across your path, trying to make you think you don't have the capacity, you don't have the, quote, the right, you don't have the ability to serve and be used of God, it's time to remember consequences may be there, but that doesn't mean there's not grace today as well. And maybe for some of you brothers and sisters, you're like, hey, I'm praying for somebody else about some of these things that they're struggling with. Maybe it'd be good to take some time to pray with them during the invitation. So let's just take a moment here. Our heads bowed. Let's take a moment. There's going to be some music play overhead. And as it plays, I'm just going to invite you and I to respond to the beautiful reality that there may be consequences, but grace still abounds.